on The Voice of America.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The UN World Health Organization says it's reached an agreement with Israel for limited pauses in fighting Gaza to allow for polio vaccinations for hundreds of thousands of children, with the campaign starting Sunday. This comes as the United Nations campaign to vaccinate hundreds of thousands of children there say that it has come too late for some. Reuters, Rachel Zuda.
Baby Abdul Rahman, days away from his first birthday and should be learning to walk. But at just 9 months of age, he became Gaza's first recorded polio case in 25 years. His mother, Naveen Abu Al-Jidyan, says he was born just weeks before the war began. And because they had been displaced from one place to another, he did not have all his routine infant vaccinations. Since 1988, cases of polio have declined by 99% worldwide, thanks to mass vaccination campaigns and efforts to continue to eradicate it completely.
AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magana reports that your European Union's top diplomat is ramping up pressure on Ukraine's Western backers to lift restrictions on using weapons they provide.
The U.S. restricts the use of long-range ballistic missiles against Ukraine, and some European nations also limit weaponry use. Kyiv is desperate to use the weapons to strike targets inside Russia, which are used to stage attacks on Ukraine. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell says the restrictions must be lifted.
Otherwise, the weaponry is useless.
Speaking alongside him in Brussels, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba says if certain decisions are made, Ukraine can succeed. If they are not, it won't. And that's on Kyiv's backers. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Ukraine's military says that one of the handful of F-16 warplanes that Ukraine has received from its Western partners to help fight Russia's invasion has crashed. Military said in a statement posted on Facebook, the fighter jet went down on Monday when Russia launched a major missile and drone barrage at Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that some of those Russian missiles and drones were shot down by F-16s before they reached their targets. The crash was the first reported loss of an F-16 in Ukraine, and where they arrived at the end of last month, and at least six of the warplanes are believed to have been delivered. AP correspondent Haya Panjwani reports on Iran's increasing its stockpile of weapons.
The United Nations nuclear watchdog says that Iran has further increased its stockpile of uranium enriched to near weapons-grade levels in defiance of international demands. That's according to a confidential report by the International Atomic Energy Agency that was seen by the Associated Press. The report says Tehran has also not reconsidered its September 2023 decision to ban the most experienced nuclear inspectors from monitoring its nuclear program, in that IAEA surveillance camera remain disrupted. The report further says that Iran has still not provided answers to the nuclear watchdog's years-long investigation about the origin and current location of man-made uranium particles. I'm Haya Panjwani.
Venezuelan opposition leader Edmundo Gonzalez will speak remotely with the foreign ministers of the 27 European Union member states on Thursday. In Brussels, the EU, the policy chief, Josep Borrell, said
he will address the ministers. But at the same time, the repression continues in Venezuela. People from the teams of the opposition have been arrested and disappearing. We are very much worried by the situation of the leaders of the opposition. So the call from Edmundo will be very important for the ministers to take stock of the situation in Venezuela.
Venezuela's Electoral Council and its top court proclaimed Maduro in power since 2013 as the winner of the July 28th election, but has not published complete voting tallies. Venezuela's opposition has published its own tallies on an opposition website showing a resounding victory for Gonzalez, giving him 67% support. Prosecutors in Mexico suggested Thursday that U.S. authorities made a deal with the Mexican drug lord who turned himself in at another capo to get his brother transferred from a U.S. prison. Mexico's Attorney General's office also accused U.S. authorities of not responding to information requests in that case. The office also said that the small plane that flew them both to the United States in July had multiple registries and identification numbers. The U.S. has denied it. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
and Hamas agreed to localize ceasefires for polio vaccines.
A two-round polio vaccination campaign will actually start on the 1st of September.
Baltic countries are moving to protect NATO's eastern border in the face of Russian aggression.
Latvia is setting up concrete structures known as Dragon Teeth as part of a Baltic defense line along the border with Russia and Belarus.
And suing the government to make the climate better. And winning.
I'm Mark Ruling from the South Korean Constitutional Court. It's a very high-level court.
Today is Friday, August 30th.
And this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Alexis Strove.
Israel and Hamas have agreed to localized ceasefires so that polio vaccines can be given to 640,000 children in Gaza. How it's expected to work in this report from Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman.
The World Health Organization on Thursday said both the Israeli military and the Palestinian militant group Hamas have agreed to abide by three separate short ceasefires in specific areas of the Gaza Strip to allow for a massive vaccination program to protect children from polio in the war-ravaged enclave.
A two-round polio vaccination campaign will actually start on the 1st of September.
Each pause in fighting will last 3 days, with hostilities halted between 6 a.m. and 3 p.m. local time each day.
And we start in central Gaza for 3 days, followed by south Gaza, and then followed by the north of Gaza.
The campaign comes after the WHO last week confirmed at least one baby has been paralyzed by the type 2 polio virus. It's the first such case in the territory in 25 years. The child, Abdul Rahman, is just days away from his first birthday. He should be learning to walk. His mother, Naveen Abu Jidyan, says he was born just weeks before the war began, and because they had been displaced from one place to another, he did not have all his routine infant vaccinations. Almost 2 months ago, she noticed something was wrong when her son couldn't crawl as usual.
Suddenly, I found a boy vomiting. He stopped moving and had a fever. He also stopped walking and crawling. I took him to the Al-Aqsa Maltayas Hospital, and I was told my son might have polio. He took antibiotics for 15 days, and they took some samples from him to Jordan. I got a call from the health ministry saying Abdul Rahman is the only child and the only detected case of polio until now. It was a shock for me.
Naveen says she's in shock, especially as she says she's been told by doctors there's little more they can do for her son.
He is my only baby boy. It's his right to travel and be treated. It's his right to walk, run, and move like before. It's his right to get the proper treatment, travel, get out, and get his chance at life. It is unfair that he stays in this tent without care or attention.
Poliomyelitis is a highly infectious virus primarily spread through the fecal-oral route. It can invade the nervous system and cause paralysis. Cases of polio have declined by 99% worldwide since 1988, thanks to mass vaccination campaigns and efforts to continue to eradicate it completely. The UN says it is now preparing to vaccinate an estimated 640,000 children in Gaza. The latest bloodshed in the decades-old Israeli-Palestinian conflict was triggered on October 7th when the Palestinian Islamist group Hamas attacked Israel, killing 1,200 and taking about 250 hostages, according to Israeli tallies. Israel's subsequent assault on the Hamas-governed enclave has since killed over 40,000 Palestinians, according to the Hamas-run health ministry.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman.
U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met with Chinese President Xi Jinping in Beijing on Thursday, wrapping up 3 days of wide-ranging talks aimed at easing tensions between the two world powers ahead of November's U.S. election. Among the issues discussed was China's actions against the Philippines' lawful maritime practices in the South China Sea.
We believe that the order of the day should be de-escalation, and we support direct discussion relations between the Philippines and the PRC to that end. We also have made very clear that our mutual defense treaty applies to public vessels, including Coast Guard vessels that are operating in the South China Sea and in other waters. It also applies to aircraft, for that matter.
Chinese officials strongly condemned the deployment of a U.S. intermediate-range missile system in the northern Philippines during exercises in April, saying it brought huge risks of war into the region.
Baltic countries are moving to protect NATO's eastern border in the face of Russian aggression. The Baltic Defense Line, a new fortification system along their borders with Russia and Belarus, is meant to shield NATO allies from potential attacks. VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief, Miroslava Gangadze, reports from the Latvia-Russian border.
It is setting up concrete structures known as Dragon Teeth as part of a Baltic defense line along the border with Russia and Belarus. Latvia's defense minister, Andris Sprus, says the Baltic countries are making progress on a January agreement to fortify NATO's eastern flank aimed Russian aggression.
We've been under some sort of hybrid offensive already for some years in terms of disinformation campaigns, weaponization of illegal migration, the cyber attacks, some kind of incidents against critical infrastructure. We've seen it. And this, again, is one example that we are doing our homework to deter aggressor country from even intention, and of course also doing our homework that we, together with our NATO allies, we strengthen our defenses.
Sprus says Russia's invasion of Ukraine prompted Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia and Poland to bolster their defenses and strengthen their borders.
What happened in Ukraine, it provided additional experience, it provided additional resolve to do it as soon and quickly as possible. So we realize how important it is exactly to defend the country and NATO territory from the very first inch of territory. So that's exactly what we are doing.
Latvia's border with Russia and Belarus extends for about 450 kilometers. Colonel Andris Dieks is with Latvia's National Armed Forces headquarters.
As a part of total defense, we have to be responsible about our part. We are relying on the NATO for sure, and also we have to do our homework. This is our homework.
Latvia's defense ministry says the country plans to invest more than $300 million over the next 5 years to fortify its border. Again, defense minister Sprus.
This year already we will be fulfilling the threshold of 3% for defense expenditure. We are among six countries which are fulfilling, let's say, that threshold.
Sprus hopes other allies will step up to invest at least 2% of their economic output on NATO defense, a guideline set by the alliance.
We see that when the war started, it was around 8-9 countries fulfilling 2% threshold. Now we see more than 20 countries. Yes, of course, we strongly advocate and motivate our partners, our allies, to invest, because at the very end, it's about one NATO. It's about capability, efficiency, and strength of one NATO.
The Eastern NATO and EU frontline countries have also requested that the European Union provide financial support for building a defensive line along the EU border with Russia and Belarus, which, according to some estimates, could cost over $2.5 billion. Miroslava Gangadze, VOA News, Latvia-Russian border.
We're also following these other stories from around the world. A woman who posted a video of herself singing outdoors in Afghanistan to protest the Taliban's morality laws says she won't be silenced. The laws include a ban on women's voices in public. The Taliban last week issued laws to prevent vice and promote virtue, including a requirement for a woman to conceal her face, body, and voice outside the home. Afghan women inside and outside the country have posted videos of themselves singing in protest of the new laws.
Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić on Thursday announced a $3 billion deal to buy 12 French warplanes, shifting his country away from its dependence on Russian arms.
The UN nuclear watchdog says that Iran has further increased its stockpile of uranium enriched to near weapons-grade levels in defiance of international demands. That's according to a confidential report by the International Atomic Energy Agency that was seen by the Associated Press on Thursday.
In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, Vice President Kamala Harris did her first sit-down interview since becoming the Democratic nominee for the presidency. On Thursday night, she spoke to CNN telling Dana Bash that she plans to appoint a Republican to her cabinet if elected. Former President Donald Trump was on the campaign trail as well, making campaign stops in various states, but his campaign has been dogged by another controversy.
At an event earlier this week at Arlington National Cemetery, there was a reported altercation between a member of the Trump campaign and an employee of the cemetery. Federal laws, Army regulations, and Department of Defense policies prohibit political activities on cemetery grounds. According to the Army, participants in the August 26th ceremony and the subsequent Section 60 visit were made aware of the laws. The Army statement goes on to say a cemetery employee who attempted to ensure adherence to these rules was abruptly pushed aside. Consistent with the decorum expected at Arlington National Cemetery, this employee acted with professionalism and avoided further disruption. The incident was reported to the police, but the employee subsequently decided not to press charges.
The Trump campaign later posted footage of the visit on its social media accounts, and veterans organizations were quick to criticize. Here's a statement from Allison Jasla, the CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Quote, "There are plenty of places appropriate for politics. Arlington is not one of them. And any aspiring elected official, especially one who hopes to be commander-in-chief, should not be confused about that fact, nor should they hide behind members of our community to justify politicking on such sacred ground." Joining us now to talk about this is Allison Jaslow. We're trying to understand the rules here and why they exist and why it's important for this kind of decorum at a national cemetery for veterans. So if we could start there, and you could explain to us the thought behind all of these rules.
I mean, just put yourself in the shoes of a family member or a friend of the fallen who may have had plans to be there to visit their loved one that day. You know, not only is it a place where folks like myself go to pay our respects to the fallen, you know, for me, it's also a humbling reminder of the fact that I was lucky enough to even make it home from Iraq. But I really, my heart goes out to somebody that maybe who would have had plans to just pay their respects and spend some time with a loved one, maybe on the anniversary of their death, whose day was otherwise compromised by politics.
This has caused a bit of a stir in the veteran community.
Mm-hmm.
But not the first time that this campaign has done that. It's without getting too political, it's you know, one of the things that I think to explain this to people in other parts of the world, and I assume it's the same in almost every country, the citizenry of the United States, one of the highest honors paid are to U.S. military veterans. And it's something that I think most people try to keep in the very front of their mind, no?
Well, I mean, there's a distinction, too, between veterans like myself and the fallen, those who've made the ultimate sacrifice. You know, our service members and their families are making immense sacrifices on our behalf. And in today's day and age, they're all volunteering to do it. But there's an elite class of our citizens who have paid the greatest price of all, and those are the ones who, you know, get real estate in Arlington National Cemetery, and I think, you know, that means that their military service occupies a very unique place in the hearts of their loved ones, but also of those who served alongside them as well. And it really is hallowed ground in Arlington National Cemetery for that reason.
This the site in which this incident allegedly occurred is also a special site because it's one of the newest, right?
Yes, the veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, or the entire, you know, war on global terrorism, are buried in Section 60. Should those fallen service members have chosen to be buried there, you know, it's a place that I visited personally many times to remind myself of the sacrifice of those who, you know, served when I did. And, you know, the global war on terror is still going on today. And so, you know, it's also fresh loss. And to me, at least when I visit Section 60, it is, again, not just for reverence, but it's a very humbling experience that gives me personally a lot of perspective. And I think, and I wish more people would go visit Section 60 for that reason. And it's unfortunate that a lot of America is learning about Section 60, you know, through a story like the one that's playing out in our national politics today.
You know, I've been to Arlington several times, and there is something overwhelmingly somber and overwhelmingly sad and proud, and this whole rush of emotion when you're there. But for the most part, I think most people that are there walk through the cemetery quietly, out of respect.
Definitely. You know, for me, it's not only quiet reverence, but, you know, it's when you walk through Section 60, I walk by headstones of people who had the same birth year as me, of people who were deployed to the same places in Iraq that I was. You know, if you go there on Memorial Day, it is even more emotional and touching because you commonly will see their loved ones there at headstones. You'll see mementos laid next to their headstones as well that sometimes can also educate you more on who they were. You know, the picture of when they were a little kid that's put next to the headstone. So it really is a special and unique place. That as you mentioned, stirs up a lot of emotion, I think.
Thank you so much for sharing all of this with us.
Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for, giving your listeners a little bit of perspective.
Allison Jeslow, the CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America.
In an interview with VOA, United Nations experts say terror groups in Africa are increasing their use of drones to carry out operations previously only possible by nation states. From Somalia to the Sahel, reporter Henry Wilkins looks at how this makes the work of African states fighting insurgencies even more difficult.
These drone images, which VOA has been unable to independently verify, purport to show Al-Shabaab's attack on an airport in Kenya in 2021. As well as the use of drones by the armed groups JNIM and ISWAP to coordinate attacks in Mali and Nigeria. According to UN experts, terror groups in Africa linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State are making increasing use of consumer drones to carry out operations. In an interview with VOA, Barbara Moraes Figueiredo, who authored a recent report on the trend for the UN's Institute for Disarmament Research, says this gives the terrorist groups improved surveillance and greater power.
Airborne capability, so allows them to have, you know, better view of the battlespace and their operating environments, also provides them with a new way of being able to gather intelligence, and in that way also to plan and coordinate attacks, you know, also sometimes with a higher degree of lethality and precision.
Experts point out that militaries fighting insurgencies and facing terrorist threats from the air for the first time are at a disadvantage. Karen Allen, a senior research advisor at the Institute for Security Studies, has written extensively on the subject of drone use by terror groups.
It conveys a significant psychological advantage to armed groups who in the past may have been at a disadvantage compared to regular armies. So it's leveled the playing field, if you like, between regular forces and irregular forces.
While it's unclear exactly how many incidences of drone use by terror groups there have been in Africa, instances have been recorded in Somalia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Nigeria, and Mozambique. Figueiredo, there's the Central Sahel, has borne the brunt of the new trend, however, which has spread from IS and Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria to their affiliates in Africa. Allen adds that the use of drones by terror groups is difficult to stop because drones are easy to buy for civilian use on the internet.
I think there is a real difficulty in being able to stop the use of a technology which is a dual-use technology. I mean, think of a mobile phone. Mobile phone can be used most of the time to be able to communicate and have a completely benign purpose, but it can also be used to trigger a tripwire and to cause an ID to explode.
She adds that African nations need to invest in anti-drone systems. This may include tech that jams radio signals, disabling drones, and even anti-drone lasers. Henry Wilkins, VOA News. International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. A Hong Kong court on Thursday found two editors of the now-defunct Stand News media outlet guilty of conspiring to publish seditious articles in a landmark case that has drawn international scrutiny. Details now from Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones.
This is the first sedition conviction against any journalist or editor since Hong Kong's handover from Britain to China in 1997. The case has received international scrutiny amid a security crackdown in a China-ruled city. The two editors, Chung Poi Kyun and Patrick Lam, who wasn't there for the verdict, could face a maximum jail term of 2 years. Stand News was once a leading online media platform in Hong Kong, featuring a mix of critical reportage and commentary. And critics of this case, including the US government, say the verdict reflects deteriorating media freedoms in the city. Stand News was raided by police in December 2021 and had its assets frozen, leading to its closure a few days later. The editors and the outlet's parent company were all charged with conspiracy to publish seditious publications in connection with 17 news articles and commentaries from July 2020 to December 2021. The articles included commentaries written by exiled activists. The editors pleaded not guilty. During the 57-day trial, the government prosecutor said Stand News had acted as a political platform to promote, quote, illegal ideologies, and incited readers' hatred against the Chinese and Hong Kong governments. When testifying in court, Chung said the site had simply sought to reflect a spectrum of voices, including pro-democracy advocates. The judge wrote in a summary that the court had considered, quote, the potential damage to national security in its ruling on seditious intent.
That was Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones.
And finally,
so today is quite a landmark ruling from the South Korean Constitutional Court.
South Korea's top court ruled in a case brought by 200 plaintiffs, including young climate activists and even some infants, who argued that their government was violating its citizens' human rights by not doing enough to safeguard their future and putting a large burden on future generations to adapt quickly to worsening effects of climate change.
Unanimously deciding basically that one of the provisions of their main climate change act does not conform with the Korean constitution.
Tiffany Chan, a climate litigation expert with the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the London School of Economics.
Since 2015, we've seen 110 such cases basically challenging a government's response to climate change. And today's ruling joins a few of those which talk specifically about future generations, so the rights of the youth and future generations. So it's a very positive ruling, and it's one of the one of the few we have in Asia specifically that looks at this issue.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, with Alexis Strope, I'm Scott Walterman.